everybody. Welcome once again to Mind Shift, the podcast that's here to help you think critically about things like God, the church, and spirituality. But of course, I don't want to limit it just to those three. We could add a lot of things: deconstructing the faith, deconstructing religion, deconstructing things you think you know, things you think you believe. And of course, one of the best ways to learn how to think critically is to be exposed to alternative points of view. And that's what I do on this podcast. I am your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, coming to you once again from The Rock here in North Wales, where I live with my wife, Lisa. And this podcast is all about, as I say, critical thinking. And today, I'm delighted to be bringing you part one of a fantastic conversation that I had recently with Karen Garst. And she contacted me about a month ago. She emailed me. And after a little bit of back and forth, we were able to set up a conversation or an interview. And so this is what I have for you today. Now, Karen is really interesting because not only is she a feminist, but she's also an atheist. She wrote a book in 2016 called Women Beyond Belief, Discovering Life Without Religion. And what she did is she interviewed 22 different women from different parts of the world, some from Africa, Germany, Europe, Great Britain here where I live, of course in America as well, and they described their journey out of Judeo-Christian religions. And this is the substance of the book. It's an absolutely fascinating read, especially for someone like myself who has come out of a fundamentalist, evangelical, conservative background, and I am in the process of deconstructing my faith. One of the things I remember hearing from Scott Watkins from The Holy Heretics was he recently stepped away from the podcast, and he said that he wasn't prepared for how the podcast actually changed him as part of the process of his own deconstruction, his own journey away from that sort of evangelical or fundamentalist Christianity. And I think that's when I started reading these testimonies of these women that Karen interviewed for her book, and I certainly resonated with a lot of the statements that these women made. In fact, let me just share one with you really quickly. This is from Anne, who was raised in a fundamentalist Christian religion. She calls it sin, the abridged version. And Anne says, quote, "In fundamentalist theology, people don't just commit sin, they are sin. Because Adam sinned, every person born after him was born with a sinful nature and is inherently corrupt. And as if that weren't enough, there were sins of commission when you did something you shouldn't, and sins of omission when you didn't do something you should. If there is another religion that vilifies humans more than fundamentalist Christianity, then I feel sorry for its adherents. We were also taught," says Anne, "that God was so holy he could not have sin or sinful beings in his presence. No one ever explained to me how this worked. Was it like kryptonite, I wondered? In addition, God's innate justice demanded that sin and sinners should be punished. So God was permanently ticked off at all humans unless they were reconciled to him through salvation. The beauty of this system is that merely by being born, and who hasn't been, humans are now in desperate need of salvation, which can only happen if they become Christians." And Anne concludes, and she says, "As a child, I felt guilty for small transgressions, even things that were normal childhood behavior, such as wishing I could stay home from church on a Sunday night to watch a Disney, or snitching an extra cookie when Mom wasn't looking. I wanted to be pretty, but I worried that I might be committing the sin of vanity, and I felt conflicted about trying to look nice. As I grew older," says Anne, "I struggled to be good so that I could stop feeling flawed and wrong, and I developed a debilitating perfectionism," end quote. Now, this is something that we've been exploring in with some of the other people that have been on this podcast, Mark Shelsky, as well as Steve Austin. We talked about the effects of toxic theology, the effects of bad teaching on people's mental health. And this is something that Karen explores in her book, and we'll be getting a little bit more into that in part two of this interview coming next week. Now, before I bring you this interview with Karen, I want to warn you a little bit. We do dip into politics, so be prepared for that. It's kind of a wide-ranging interview, but in my mind, as I talk to Karen, I'm trying to get my head around the whole context of American, specifically American Christianity. It's so wrapped up in politics. It's such part and parcel of the whole American worldview. And these women are coming out of them, at least a lot of them, are coming out of that context. So in my mind, I'm trying to understand where Karen's coming from, both as a feminist and as an atheist, and someone who's talked to a lot of different women who have come out of this context. So this is a very wide-ranging interview. We get into a lot of things beyond her book. I was absolutely fascinated, and we end up going into a lot of different things. So be prepared for that in this upcoming conversation, which I'll be bringing you just in a minute. I want to say really quickly before I get into the conversation with Karen that you can contact me on a variety of ways in terms of social media. This particular podcast episode, I'm hoping, will stimulate some conversation, some discussion. So please email me or tweet me or follow me on Facebook, something. You can get a hold of me a variety of different ways, and I'll be bringing you that at the end of the conversation with Karen. So let's go ahead and get into it. Let's talk to Karen Garst, the author of Women Beyond Belief, Discovering Life Without Religion, Part 1, right here on Mindshift. All right, I'm here with Karen Garst. You're actually Dr. Karen Garst, but you said you like to go by Karen. Is that right?
That's right.
Well, thank you so much for contacting me. We've had kind of a garbled communication, didn't we, at the beginning? But I think you had me confused with somebody else. I thought, how did you get my information? But you emailed me, what was it, about 2-3 weeks ago, I think it was. You heard about the podcast.
You were the fastest responder I've ever had on a request. So thank you.
Yes, well, you're definitely welcome. I'm very much excited to be talking to Karen today. I mean, you have a phenomenal story in this book that you've written. Can you tell us a little bit about why you wrote the book? What's the title of the book and sort of what the aim of the book is?
Well, the name of the book is Women Beyond Belief, Discovering Life Without Religion. And it is a composition, an anthology of 22 essays of women telling their story about leaving religion. And they're from age 18 to 70. One was born in Zimbabwe. One was born in Peru, and Germany, England, the United States. So it's a real good variety of people.
Yeah, I noticed that I was reading through it, there was a wide range of women, not just from the States, are there? You got women from really a lot of different countries around the world.
Yes, and the reason, what prompted me, I would say I've probably been an atheist since the mid-90s. I read a lot of books, and I read Bishop John Shelby Spong's book, Resurrection, Myth or Reality. And once I gave up on the resurrection, that was it. And my husband and I were attending this kind of almost a secular church, if you will. And when it went belly up, we quit going. And I think kind of what's interesting, I never looked for another group. I never checked out any atheist group, secular group, Sunday assembly or anything. We just slept in on Sundays and went on with our lives. But in 2014, the United States Supreme Court issued a decision in Burwell v. Hobby Lobby. And what they said was, Hobby Lobby, which was a privately held company, wasn't publicly traded, that their religious beliefs prevented them from providing certain forms of birth control to their female employees. And the court, in a 5-4 decision, upheld their right to do that, because previously in Citizens United, they said a corporation is a person, so if it's a person, it can have religious beliefs. And I became incensed. I thought, you know, I became active and a feminist in the 60s and 70s, and I said, we're still arguing about birth control? Now, while it is true that the government picked up the cost, you have to ask yourself what's next. And to me, once you enter the public domain, once you're on that public sidewalk with a business, whether it's selling cakes or crafts or whatever, you have to abide by all the laws and you have to accept everyone into your store. Either that or don't do it. So I decided to write a book, particularly about women and their stories of how devastating religion can be to women.
Yeah, I noticed that you mentioned Hobby Lobby. They were in the news just recently, weren't they? The CEO of Hobby Lobby is trying to open up a museum of the Bible. Have you heard about this? I think it's in New York City. Did you hear about that?
Yeah, they were charged with taking certain artifacts out of the Middle East.
Yes, and there's been some heat generated around that whole museum of the Bible, because even though he argues that it's not a particular evangelical Christian conservative viewpoint, it actually is. It's not just honoring the Bible as an ancient Near Eastern document. It's definitely seems to be coming from a very much conservative, you know, point of view, isn't it? Where you're actually, it's more about proselytizing people. So there's definitely something going on with the Hobby Lobby, isn't it? Even though, like you say, it's a publicly traded company, isn't it?
No, it's not it's a privately traded company. It's a privately held. Otherwise, I don't think the court would issue a decision if it were publicly traded. If it does, we've got even bigger problems.
Yeah, so
but it's kind of like Ken Ham's Ark. I mean, obviously, his building the Ark is to push Christianity. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
Yes. Yes, he's built a life-size replica of the Ark, Noah's Ark, it's in Kentucky? It's part of the Creation Museum or something like that, isn't it? Supposedly a huge tourist mm-hmm. attraction and everything else. Ken Ham, he's a young earth creationist and a very biblical literalist and everything else. You'd have to say, even though he's from Australia, only in America, you know, would something like this happen. But there's a guy in the Netherlands that built a full size ark as well. So it's not just confined to America, is it?
Crazy people are all over the world.
Yeah, and if they could find Noah's Ark on Mount Ararat, the conservative Christians would be absolutely just over the moon, wouldn't they? You know, they could then somehow prove that the Bible is true, that the book of Genesis is historically accurate and everything else. It's unbelievable what links they will go to. But this is the question. I mean, do you feel like in America in particular, in terms of, you know, social discourse, that Christianity is something that is even can you have a nuanced discussion anymore? Or is that sort of gone by the wayside?
Well, I think with the election of Donald Trump, it's gone downhill. The rhetoric, the anti-abortion rhetoric, the anti-women rhetoric, and his appointment of Neil Gorsuch, very conservative to the Supreme Court. I don't think Roe v. Wade would be overturned today, but if he gets a couple more appointments, it probably would be. And at that point in time, we'll start the women's revolution.
Yeah, you back to the suffragettes and everything else. Yeah, it's crazy.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. So I take it you're not a Trump supporter.
I supported Bernie, but I did vote for Hillary.
Yes. Yes. You're one of those extra 3 million people that voted illegally, obviously. Yeah.
Well, it's... I often say that my 10-year-old granddaughter is more articulate than he is, and. Actually, I bet she's read more books than he has.
Probably, yeah. I'm not sure if he's ever read a book all the way through as an adult, so they say. But it's interesting because you talk about Donald Trump. I mean, I know this isn't really the subject of your book, but it does relate, isn't it? Because there's that 81% of white evangelical Christian voters that voted for Trump, and a large number of those continue to support him even now, you know, almost a year into his presidency. You know, that's got to play into what you're talking about with these women. Would you say in some level, as far as this sort of culture war between conservative Christianity and the rest of society almost, it's so polarized, isn't it, in American politics and religion, you can't, like I say, you can't seem to have a nuanced discussion anymore. It's very much black or white, isn't it?
I think it's very difficult. I think it's really changed. As I said, I think the rhetoric is amped up, and you could not get elected to the National Senate or House of Representatives as an atheist. Even though we have separation of church and state technically in our Constitution, somebody who was openly an atheist, said they didn't believe in God, wouldn't get elected in our country.
Yeah, they couldn't get elected as a dog catcher, as they say. You have to be seen to be a Christian, in air quotes, in terms of still in American politics, right? I mean, the fact that so many evangelical pastors and leaders endorse Trump and continue to support him. It's just my question I keep coming back to is, where is the Christian church in America going to be once his presidency is over, however it ends, whether he's impeached or Article 25, or if it's a case of he just finishes out his term? You know, they think they've won the culture war by electing him because he promised to support so many of their religious liberties. But in a way, I think they're going to be far worse off when this whole thing is done. What's your take on all that?
Well, I think that really depends. If he's impeached and Pence becomes president, I think we're going to be in trouble, because I think Pence is smarter. He would work better with Congress, and he is very, very conservative.
Yeah, he's very, you'd almost say, fundamentalist in his way. And this is the question, yes. I guess, you know, coming back to the topics of reading about the experiences of some of the women in your book, you know, is there a difference between religion and Christianity? Or can you even make that distinction? Because as you say, it seems to be so black and white, certainly in America today. You know, is there a place for Christianity anymore? What has it become? How has it become what it is today? I call it, it's a system. You have to prop up the system, and it's just become this capitalistic sort of self-perpetuating system. I don't know if it has anything to do with the message of Jesus, whatever that may be. A lot of people disagree on even what the message of Jesus might have been.
Yeah, I think people cling to religion primarily out of a sense of community. I'm sure there's a lot of people who are in those pews on Sundays who don't believe the Bible is literal, aren't young earth creationists, but they go, they've always gone, their parents went, and they take their children, and there's music, and there's rituals, and so they just keep doing it. Not very many people read anything critical about something they believe in. They will read what reinforces their belief, but they don't very often read something that's critical. And I was just finished reading a book by, it's called Putting Away Childish Things by Uta Rank Heinemann. And, you know, it's probably about the 100th book I read about religion. But as I go through that, you just stop and think, okay, let me see. Eve ate a fruit from a tree, and then we're all sinners, and then God decided that the only way to help us was to have his son killed. You know, you stand back and look at that, you know, and it's ridiculous. I mean, it's this whole issue of child sacrifice. You know, whether it was the Mayans or the early Israelites, whatever. But people don't look at that critically. They believe it. And when I was raised in a pretty moderate Lutheran church. But, you know, we were taught the story of Abraham and Isaac, and God intervened, and so Isaac wasn't sacrificed. But nobody told us about the story of Jephthah, where he said to God, hey, if I get to beat the Ammonites, I'll sacrifice the first person who walks out of my house. And it's his daughter. And God doesn't intervene. Daughter gets killed. Yeah. And I often wonder, my father was very religious and read the Bible every day, what he thought when he came past those passages, or what he thought when he came past the red tent, that women were unclean and had to spend their, you know, menstrual period in a tent. And as I say, and I have a YouTube channel called Faithless Feminist, where you can see a presentation I've done called From Goddess to God, Elimination of the Female Divine. All of these motifs were to put down the female goddess, that Asherah, that was worshipped in Canaan at the time the Israelites came there. So, you know, Asherah is associated with a tree. Great, we'll have a tree in the garden. You know, she's a goddess, so we'll put down Eve. Snake was associated with a goddess, so we'll make the bad guy the snake. And all through the Bible, there are these appropriations from other cultures. If you were talking about the Ark a few minutes ago, if you look at Gilgamesh, and I did this in one of my blog posts at www.faithlessfeminist.com, I showed almost a one-to-one correspondence with everything that's said about Noah and everything that's said in this Babylonian myth, Gilgamesh. So, you know, that's how culture is reproduced. You take a little here, you take a little there, you modify it, you have a purpose to a metaphor, like putting down women, et cetera, and you go with it. And people don't see that.
Yeah, what strikes me, right, what's going on right now with, you know, some of these things, there's this sort of progressive Christian theology movement that's happening right now. But it's questioning, like you say, there are a lot of people out there who are questioning those things that you just mentioned and questioning, you know, this whole, the official party line about the Bible is the inerrant, inspired, infallible word of God. Because once you go down that road, you're kind of painting yourself into a corner, I think, because you're forced then to defend every single proclamation in the Bible, aren't you? You have to.
Exactly.
And the tradition I came out of was a very fundamentalist sort of, I resonated with a lot of the women's testimonies in the book because it struck me that, yeah, that's the tradition I came out of. And I just was raised in the tradition. I never thought to question it because that was the truth. We were just told, and I went to Bible college, I went to seminary, I did 2 master's degrees, and I was the frog in the boiling water. I was just, you know, not questioning it because that's what I was told and that's what I thought was true. And I went out, became a pastor, and I was the one up there saying all these things from the pulpit, reinforcing it, you know. So I've been on this process of deconstruction myself for the last probably 10 years. And I look at that person that I was back then. I think, I don't even know who that guy was. I seriously don't know who that guy was, who was saying all those things. And I question these things myself. So this is one of the things I'm working on a lot is I resonate, like I say, with your book, because the toxic effects of these sort of teachings is unbelievable. What is it that struck you about hearing these women's testimonies? What would you say is the most kind of striking thing?
Well, other than the ones who came from Europe, who were deconverted pretty easily, if you will, if they really didn't have any, you know, really strong push on religion where they were born. But the fundamentalists, you know, I look at some of those, or the Jehovah's Witness or Mormon, and I go, they had it a lot worse than I did. I went to a Lutheran college in Minnesota called Concordia College. And what was interesting about that, this was, you know, in the late 60s and 70s, it was very liberal. My first course on Religion 101 talked about the different oral strains of the Old Testament and explained why we have 2 versions of the Garden of Eden. Why do we have 2 versions of Exodus? Because different people wrote at different times and they added it. And unfortunately, the P strain, which is the priestly, when he edited it, he didn't have a very sharp pen and left a lot of the incongruities in there.
Yeah, if you start questioning those things, I remember having a discussion when I was at Bible college with one of the lecturers there, and I started bringing up these issues, and he got very upset and angry. You know, you can't have, in those circles, you can't have those discussions. You know, what I was told was basically, if a biblical book has the name of an author on it, like Isaiah or Jonah, that person's the one who wrote it. You know, Moses wrote the Pentateuch, even including the part where he predicted his own death at the end, apparently, before he died, they can't even admit that he didn't write the ending of the book of Deuteronomy. If he did indeed write the whole Pentateuch, it's, you know, that's what I mean. They have to paint themselves. They are painting themselves into a corner, aren't they? And doing backflips to try and explain how these things have to be totally 100% down the line. If you go down the inerrancy route and the inspiration inerrancy route, I had one of my students up in Leeds when I used to teach Bible there. I was asking this question about the Word of God and everything and making him think. And then after the class, she came up to me and she said, "Are you even a Christian?" Yeah. And I said, why would you say that? I'm teaching in a Christian theological school, aren't I? And she said, "Yeah, but you're questioning the Bible. You can't be a Christian and question the Bible." You know, so that's kind of what we're dealing with. We're dealing with that sort of knee-jerk reaction. It's very hard to have a, like I say, a nuanced discussion in some context, isn't it?
Well, and I think if you trace politically in the United States what happened, in the 19th century, Roger Ingersoll and Helen Gardner, they were on the speaking tour, and Robert Ingersoll is credited with kind of getting rid of the fire and brimstone. At least they toned it down a little. Well, then in the 50s, you have communism. And so it kind of ratchets up again. And then you find in the, in the 50s through the 70s, what happens, issues like abortion become a wedge strategy. And they find out that if they bring that up, it's going to divide the Democrats. So it's political more than anything else. And this whole issue of young earth creationism is almost a recent phenomenon. I grew up in a conservative place in Bismarck, North Dakota, and our science teacher taught us about evolution. I remember doing a paper on early man, and my father, who was very religious, totally supported evolution. So this is something that's come out in the last, 30, 40 years, that's really been taken to an extreme by people like Ken Ham and the other person you were referencing.
Yeah, Institute for Creation Research or whatever they call it. Although you can trace it back to, I was going to say, what's happening now reminds me a lot of the whole sort of liberal fundamentalist debates around the turn of the century up to about the 1920s or 30s. You have the Scopes monkey trial and things like that, because the liberals were doing exactly the same thing that you're saying now, questioning the veracity of the Bible, questioning the authorship, the editing process, and the fundamentalists reacted just as strongly, maybe perhaps stronger in some ways. It was a public culture war, wasn't it? And that's, I think it's what led to things like the religious right in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, the moral majority, people like Jerry Falwell. And you can trace that lineage out of the fundamentalist movement in the turn of the century right up to what's happening today with those 81% evangelical voters who supported Trump. They were saying he's going to preserve our religious freedom. It's under assault. And so we have to put this man in the office and ignore all of the glaring, moral problems and everything else that he had. Because they hated Hillary more, apparently. They were more afraid of her, I guess.
Well, there's I had read somewhere talking about exactly what you're saying, and it said, prior to creating the moral majority, Jerry Falwell couldn't spell the word abortion.
Right. It wasn't an issue.
It wasn't an issue. And in fact, in the 19th century, the Catholic Church allowed abortion up to the time of quickening, when the fetus moves inside a woman's uterus. So, and that change had a lot to do with male doctors coming on the scene, because the midwives, did the abortion, did the labor delivery, and they said, wait a sec, we want to get in on this. This is lucrative. We want to do it. And so there's almost always a political edge to something. But it's really amazing today, with all the information available to people, that they're not checking something out. And I think the podcasts are great. I think a lot of young people today, whether they're out running or driving a car, they'll listen to a podcast. There's just so much more information available. But America's unique. You see the Scandinavian countries have let go a religion, and Iceland is one of the least religious countries in the world. And just by chance, it is the first in gender equity, pay equity between men and women. I received an email today from a young man who's studying in college, and he was a subscriber to my blog. And he was writing a paper, and he was going to write it about what if women had been treated equal in the Bible, would we be in a different place today? And I go, yeah.
I think.
And different issues like that. And I, gave him some additional information, et cetera. But for me, growing up in Bismarck in the 50s and 60s, I don't think I'd ever heard the word atheist. Every single student I knew, I could tell you what church they went to. There were 5 Jewish families. I could tell you who went to the Catholic high school. And then we had, Presbyterians, Methodists, Lutheran, lots of Lutherans, because it was a German, Norwegian background for a lot of people. And just everyone did. And I, we had this encyclopedia called Collier's, 20 volumes of Collier's Encyclopedia, and I held on to those for, oh God, 30 years. And finally, nobody wanted them, and so I recycled them. But I'm going to have to get online someday and go back and look and see what Collier's Encyclopedia said about atheism. Hmm. But I didn't even know what the word meant.
Yeah, you'd never heard of it.
Didn't even think about it. Let me read one of these essays, excerpt from one of these essays. I'm going to read The Fundamentalist first because I think that really has religion has such a lasting impact on people. And when you force something on children, it's indoctrination. And when you teach them that they're going to die in hell and burn in hell unless they clean their plate at night, that's going to influence them forever. So this woman, Anne, she had left religion 30 years earlier, and she says, as I tried to let my beliefs go, my head seemed far ahead of the rest of me. I would think, that makes no sense, but I would be assailed by intense fear and doubt. I felt all of my old fears and beliefs still skulking inside, like the biblical Leviathan, a sea monster that lurked in the deep. I felt wrong, as though I had committed a terrible crime and I was going to be punished. Whenever I got near anything to do with my religion, a Christian coworker, a bumper sticker, a debater, a speaker, something on the internet or the news, even or especially my own family, I went into a tailspin of dread and doubt for days. I kept thinking the fear would diminish, but it went on for months and months. My fear was so ingrained that as I wrestled with my beliefs, I had shadowy nightmares. And I felt like things were creeping up on me in the middle of the night. As I sat in my chair reading, there were times when I involuntarily glanced upward, as if lightning might crash through my ceiling. When I attacked my beliefs about Satan, it felt as if he was in my room with me. This was a complete surprise, not to mention freaky. After 30 years away from my religion, my mind was still being assaulted with irrational fear for disbelieving.
Wow, that's powerful, isn't it? I mean, it strikes me that there's a couple of different levels there, isn't there? Because you have fundamentalism in general. You know, like you said, people being indoctrinated. I mean, my experience was very much like hers. I grew up in this environment. I watched those. They made us watch those movies about, you know, being raptured and being left behind. And I was terrified that I was going to be left behind. But then you have women in particular. Do you feel that women in that context are even more damaged, perhaps, than just your general, you know, sort of population? I don't know. What's your take on women in particular growing up in that fundamentalist context?
Well, I think women hearing that Eve is responsible for sin.
That's a big one, yeah.
Has a profound effect because you're told that it was the woman who sinned first. It's her fault. And because of her, we have this legacy of sins. Now, there's a lot of female Christian apologists who will say, oh, no, it was both of them. She gave it to him, and Adam took it too, and they were both damned. But clearly, the role of women in that society, and whether it's having to go to the red tent or not having, in the New Testament, having to cover your head and you can't speak out, it's hard to think that a woman could go through that, even not a fundamentalist, and not be impacted by it. I think the biggest impact religion had on me was sex. And part of it was a culture of the time, and part of it was religion. But for me, I was taught I had to be a virgin until I married. And I remember in college, I was going to go after the dorm situation, rent an apartment with these two women, and they said, well, we just can't rent with you because we're sleeping with our boyfriends and you don't believe in that.
Right. And you're going to be a downer to the party.
They kind of rejected me because of that. And then when I did sleep with somebody, it was somebody who had asked me to marry him, and I thought we were going to be married. So what's the diff if we start a little early? Well, after sleeping with him, I never saw him again in my life.
Yeah. So
never saw him again.
The classic, yeah. He told you whatever he needed to tell you to get you in bed, and that was it.
Yeah, and, you know, having no sex education in school, my parents never did anything regarding sex education. that can't help but affect your attitude. And it's not healthy. It is not wholesome. I mean, we talked to our son very early on about those issues, and he has a very normal attitude towards that. But we were just, you know, you don't do it, you don't talk about it, and that can really affect people. But I think for children to be told, as I said earlier, about eternal damnation, early childhood.
Yeah, I mean, one of the women, I can't remember which one it was, she said in particular she felt, as a child growing up in a fundamentalist home, she was silenced, she was repressed, she was not listened to, and there like you say, there's got to be something behind it. There's a dogma, there's a doctrine that goes back to, even as you say, the Adam and Eve story, and then you see it picked up in the New Testament, don't you? Paul talks about it, you know, well, this is why women have they can't have authority over a man, they're the weaker sex. And she's the one who was led astray, and then she led Adam astray. She was the first one to make the mistake, and then he went along with it, I guess. So, you know, well, we've got to treat women terribly, I guess, and certainly in churches. I mean, I can remember sitting in Bible college, one of my first classes there, I was starting out as a freshman, and this guest speaker came in to teach a class, this woman. And as soon as she started talking, one of the students raised his hand and she said, yes, can I help you? And he said, you have no authority to teach me in this class because I'm a man and there are men in this room. That's what the Bible says, you know, and here's this woman, she has a PhD. And yet this guy, a freshman Bible college student, calls her out almost the first day of school. And says, you have no authority to teach me. Why are you even here? It's unbelievable. That level of sexism at a fairly, I guess, evangelical Bible college. It wasn't fundamentalist, but it was pretty conservative. So this is the kind of thing, this is the people we're dealing with.
And the other issue, I believe, is that, particularly in the Catholic Church, the other model you have, other than sinful Eve, is the Virgin Mary. Okay, let me see. So if I stay a virgin my whole life, I'm going to be like the Virgin Mary.
Right.
you know, and it kept on expanding with, you know, she's a virgin as she was born of a virgin, and then she goes to heaven, and it's really amazing to see how women are portrayed, more so perhaps in the Old Testament, but, you know, the New Testament as well. Jesus talks about, you know, the woman was being stoned for adultery, and he says, ye who is without sin should cast the first stone, but they don't change the law. You know, he doesn't change the law. They're still going to, you know, maybe not this time, another time, they're going to stone a woman for adultery.
Right. He may be pointing out the hypocrisy of the system, but not necessarily doing anything about it. All right, everybody, thank you so much for joining myself and Karen Garst as we talked about, like I said before, a wide range of topics. Yes, we got into politics, but as I said before, it's all, in my understanding, part and parcel of the whole American scene. And, you know, when you look at fundamentalism in general, and we're not just talking about Christianity, you can be a fundamentalist Muslim or Jewish person. In fact, we just watched a show on Netflix called One of Us, which is about a fundamentalist Hasidic Jewish community in New York. And you look at the way people are treated, specifically women, and this is the subject, of course, of Karen's book, is women who've come out of Christian fundamentalist as well as other Judeo-Christian religion. There's a couple of layers to this thing. One is that people are subjugated, they are brainwashed oftentimes as children, but then when you look at women in particular, oftentimes they say that they're silenced, they're treated terribly as children, they're repressed, they're not listened to, there's a gender inequality right from the very beginning. And this is what I'm trying to unpack with Karen is, you know, religion versus Christianity. Is there a difference? What's the difference between religion and religionism? And this is something I'm going to be developing a little bit more in future podcasts. I've got an interview scheduled later this week with a friend of mine, and we're going to be getting into some of these topics, so stay tuned for that. Now, if this episode has been thought-provoking, challenging, irritating, angering, whatever, if it's affected you at all, I want to hear about it. Let me know. You can email me, for example, preachersforum@gmail.com, and I will respond to you. You can also follow me on Twitter and send me a direct message at Preachers Forum. And it's the same on Instagram at Preachers Forum. You can also drop by and like my Facebook page. You can get a hold of me that way, facebook.com/The Preachers Forum. You can also check out preachersforum.com/blog, where I've written a lot of articles on this subject of deconstructing Christianity, systematic theology, leaving the church to find God, leaving the church to find myself, and I'm always adding new content, so make sure and check out the Preachers Forum blog on my website, preachersforum.com. I'll just say one last thing before I let you go. If you found the work of Mindshift helpful at all, challenging at all, helping you to think critically, you can always consider supporting my work on Patreon for as little as $1 a month. What can you buy for a dollar anyway? The answer is nowadays not much, even at Walmart. But if for as little as a dollar a month, you can help support the work of Mindshift and help me cover my expenses. Now, I would be doing this for free anyway. I love doing this. I love talking to people like Karen and other people that I've had on this show. So I definitely plan on continuing doing it, but your support is greatly appreciated. So you can go to patreon.com/preachersforum and find out a little bit more about why I started this podcast, at least what used to be called the Preachers Forum podcast, and I've changed it to Mindshift, and I'll talk a little bit more about that as well on another podcast. But for now, I'm going to let you go. Be sure and come back next Friday for part two of my interview with Karen Garst as we get more into the subject of the women in her book and talking about some of the testimonies and some of the effects of leaving religion and what that's done to women in particular. So be sure and stay tuned. Come back next Friday for part two of my interview with Karen Garst. So thank you once again for joining me here on Mindshift. I'm your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, and I'll see you next week.